Coming up, it's Philosophy Talk.
During the course of this radio show, you could get your own genome sequence for maybe $1,000. That will happen within the decade.
From bioprospecting to designer genes and synthetic life forms.
Welcome to the brave new world.
We have 100 trillion combinations of our genetic code. It's not just one.
Are we wise enough to create synthetic life forms?
I think we're afraid of those ideas. We have a challenge of science education in this country. That's one of the biggest challenges we face for the future.
Our guest is noted scientist and entrepreneur Craig Venter.
We're very good at funding things we know the answer for in this country. My genome sequence is on the internet. I'm not the least bit worried about it.
Recorded before a live audience at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C.
The promise and perils of the new genomics. Coming up on Philosophy Talk, after the news. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today, we've taken Philosophy Talk on the road. We're recording the program in front of a live audience at the Smithsonian Institution here in Washington, D.C.
Our thinking originates at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
And from that oasis of thought, we migrate to this oasis of the air, and from the air to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo. I think, therefore, I blog. Go check it out.
Today's program is made possible by the Smithsonian Associates. The good folks at Smithsonian Associates heard our program on the web, and they decided to invite us here to give a live program to the Smithsonian. We're very pleased to accept their invitation and delighted you folks chose to join us.
Folks, welcome to Philosophy Talk. Our topic today is the promise and perils of genomics. John, I think we're entering a great new age. We've mapped the human genome. We don't quite know what all the genes do, but they're going to figure that out. And once we figure that out, it's just going to be in a marvelous decade, couple of decades, century of invention and discovery. It's going to be amazing.
Well, it will be amazing. It's an incredible intellectual accomplishment to understand the informational architecture of all life, including human life. But your optimism, as usual, I don't exactly share. I really admire your kind of unquenchable, juvenile enthusiasm for every new discovery that rolls down the road. But usually humans discover things long before they have the social, intellectual, and moral institutions to deal with them. And you say, once we understand how the gene works, well, once we really understand how the gene works, we probably will have been fiddling with it for 50 years and caused all kind of damage. Think of the dams that were built before we understood the environment and ecology. Think of atomic energy and all the things that were done before we really realized the dangers of radiation.
I grant you, there's a lot at stake. There's a lot at stake. Lots can go wrong. Wisdom doesn't always keep pace with knowledge. And you're right about social institutions. Think of this. To make these genetic discoveries, often people, scientists have to go prospecting for raw genetic material in the developed world, because that's where all the raw genetic material is, or lots and lots of it. And the third world countries say, we own that stuff. And the biotech companies say, we're going to make the patents. And it's a huge mess. It's a huge mess. And who knows where it's going to lead. So I grant you there are problems and perils, but I have to admit, I am utterly optimistic. The advance of science can't be stopped, and it's on balance a darn good thing. Don't you agree?
Not particularly. I agree with it. It can't be stopped, and I think it's a very impressive thing. Probably by the time we are ready to harvest all the genomic resources of the third world, which mostly stretches around the equator, we will have warmed it up due to the unanticipated consequences of the Industrial Revolution to such a point that they're all dead.
Yeah, but some biotech company will have engineered some bacteria that can take all the bad stuff out of the atmosphere, and we'll be saved.
So, the ocean will be full of genetically modified bacteria that absorb all the CO2, and it'll all work out. Well, I certainly hope so. Like you, I'm a cup is half full kind of guy. I just like to look and see what it's half full of.
Well, you know what? For some expert opinion, why don't we talk to some scientists on the front line? And that's what our roving philosophical reporter, Polly Stryker, did. She files this report.
Scientists finished sequencing the human genome in 2003. They described it as a narrative of the journey of our species through time and called the map of human DNA a textbook of medicine. This sounds terrific, but what's the promise of the genomic revolution? And is there a dark side to cracking the code of life?
The promise of gene therapy is very clear. If you could introduce a new, quote, good, unquote, copy of a gene to replace or overcome a, quote, bad copy of that gene, then you could cure a genetic disease in an infant or an embryo.
Huntington Willard is director of the Institute for Genome Sciences and Policy at Duke University.
There are a number of genes that have been identified for a large number of cancers. For breast cancer, ovarian cancer, prostate cancer, lung cancer, various brain cancers. And that information will take us to an era of true health care, as opposed to what in this country we now have, which is actually sick care.
So what happens if I find out from my genome that I'm predisposed to breast cancer?
You wouldn't have every woman going for a mammogram on their 40th birthday. Some women would need that on their 26th birthday. Other women might not need that for another decade or two. And so you would actually personally tailor health care specifically related to their personal genome characteristics.
Mapping the genome allows scientists to work on altering genes, like engineering T cells to fight cancer, or correcting faulty genes like cystic fibrosis in utero.
And then people begin to get a little concerned from a philosophical point of view about what is the nature of us as humans in our genome, and if we interfere with that, are we in a sense playing God or making decisions about what the genome should be that are inappropriate for us as human beings to make?
The fact is, our very ability to map a person's DNA raises ethical issues.
Do we have safeguards for storing private information like that in an electronic format? Who's going to get this information and what are they going to use it for?
The fallout from this is that there's been an expansion of DNA databases, both in the healthcare system and also in the area of criminal justice.
Sujatha Bhairavan is president of the Council for Responsible Genetics and a molecular biologist by training. She agrees with Dr. Willard and raises other concerns about the use of genome data.
You know, there has been a resurgence of discussion around race and criminal behavior, and that, as you can imagine, has led to sort of the reappearance of discussions on eugenics. And I would predict that it is leading to class-based medicine.
Does Bhairavan think the mapped human genome is a Pandora's box scenario?
I don't know how one can go back. That is not possible. Maybe we can expand our discussion of the role of other molecules in determining our biology and perhaps acknowledge that this emphasis on DNA and this enormous amount of money that was invested in this was perhaps not a wise decision.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Polly Stryker.
Thanks, Polly. You're listening to Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. I'm John Perry. Along with me, Ken Taylor.
And we're joined by a very special guest. That's Dr. Craig Venter. He's a major player in this issue. He's founder and former CEO of Celera Genomics, founder, current director of the Craig Venter Institute, founder, chairman, and CEO of Synthetic Genomics. Dr. Venter, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
It's a pleasure to be here. Please call me Craig.
Okay, Craig. John Perry here. You heard Ken and I fumble around about genomics, your specialty. Maybe now you could give us a little primer on genomics and maybe tell us why we should all care about it and why, as I assume, you think it's a good thing that we've got all this knowledge about it.
I didn't know if we were going to end up with two thumbs up in the end. It sounded like a movie critique, but most people don't even know what their genome is. It's our collection of all our genes, our genetic material that we've inherited from our parents. And we get two complete sets of chromosomes, one from each of our parents, and in that information makes each one of us a totally unique individual. We've read now this complete genetic code, and we're starting in the earliest stages of interpretation, and I think it tells us a lot looking back. We'll be able to determine our evolutionary as well as our genetic history. And unlike almost anything else in the history of humanity, it gives us a chance to look forward and maybe predict some things about the future.
And, I mean, I understand that people think a golden age is about to happen. Many, many people think a golden age is about to happen. So biotechnology, designer drugs, designer genes, synthetic organisms. I mean, is that right? Are we entering a kind of golden age?
Sidney Brenner said the day after we announced the sequence of the human genome at the White House that he woke up the next morning and nothing had changed. So it is a new age, and I think there'll be a bright line drawn in history looking back of before we could read genetic code and after we can read it. But it's not an instant set of miracles to anything, but I think we're just starting just in this decade to move things much more rapidly to some of these breakthroughs that you optimistically and correctly look forward to.
Now, in the popular press, you read a lot about discovering the gene for this and the gene for that. And some of the reading I've done, it suggests it's really much more complex. It's like if you had discovered the assembly code that makes a computer work, and you were trying to figure out what difference that made at the level of, say, the information that you used in daily life. It wouldn't be at all simple. There isn't just one piece of code for your balance at this bank. And so that there's really a big step, even having the code, to figuring out what it does at the larger and larger levels, up to the level of an individual human life or even a society. Is that right?
You're absolutely correct. And it's unfortunate. I think it started with scientists trying to overly simplify things for the public, and then now the press uses this very bad nomenclature. We all have the same genes. Mm-hmm. So there is no such thing as a breast cancer gene or a colon cancer gene. These are minor variations that sometimes have a statistical association, but not an absolute causal effect.
I want to push on that just a little bit more, because one of the things that surprises me, and I guess surprised a lot of scientists, I'm not sure, people made different predictions about how many genes there were going to be, and they were, and for a while, I mean, I guess the 80s, people were saying 150,000 genes or something like that. I mean, the numbers were large.
It actually, and then got, they got small, 300,000.
And then they got smaller, but I guess when you guys were all done, it was something like 30,000, is that right?
It's even less. It's on the order of 23 or 24,000, and that really upset a lot of people when we first reported that, because the year before we reported that the fruit fly has 13,000 genes, and people thought, well, we have to be much more important than the fruit fly. We must have 10 times that many, maybe 30 or 40 times, and we only had twice as many as a fruit fly, and that was quite disturbing.
But that suggests to me we are much more of sort of phenotypically complex than the fruit fly. So to get from the genes...
Why do you think that?
Well, I don't know. Maybe
speak
I'm wrong.
Speak for yourself.
We do a lot more complicated things, language,
we're
society.
We're a lot bigger than the fruit fly.
But it must be some complicated story from how you get to these 23,000 genes to these complex organisms, right? I mean, that strikes me as just like intriguing, deeply intriguing. How does that happen?
Well, you should move into this field, because we need people asking those kind of questions. But it's very different when we look at a single cell. So it's only been 11 years since we decoded the first genome of a living species. It was a bacteria that causes meningitis and ear infections in children. We have trouble understanding the complete genetic code and how that cell is alive in a single cell. We have 100 trillion cells. That's not what you see when you look at me. That's not what I see when I look at you. But it's 100 trillion combinations of our genetic code. It's not just one.
Wow. So, and I understand a lot of this genetic material is, so to speak, only of historical relevance. It's something that we got from adaptations ages old, in previous
You're
things.
That, junk
that
DNA,
really what
right?
makes a difference is relatively small. Is that kind of right?
Well, only about 3% of our genetic code codes for genes, things that code for proteins. But it's not clear that it's junk. We're still learning what it is, and... Sidney Brenner made the distinction between junk and rubbish. You throw out rubbish, junk you store in your attic.
So there's a lot of science left to be done, right? There's a lot of genomic science left to be done.
Most of science remains to be done.
Yeah. This is a special edition of Philosophy Doc, coming to you from the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. We're discussing genomics, its peril and promise, with our guest, Craig Venter.
We've been talking about what the science of genomics reveals about life and life's processes. Coming up, we'll dig into some of the practical applications and possible social consequences of this new knowledge.
Designer genes, life-saving drugs, synthetic life forms, plus questions and comments from our live studio audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Well, as I'm sure everyone here in our audience at the Smithsonian Institute recognized, that was Telepop Musique and their hit Genetic World. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk. We're discussing the promise and peril of genomics in front of a live studio audience at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. Our guest is scientist and entrepreneur Craig Venter.
Applied genomics may alter forever medicine and healthcare, or even the production of energy, maybe the conduct of warfare. The economic and social stakes are enormous. Will this new knowledge be used for the benefit of humanity at large, or will it enrich the few and create genomic haves and have-nots? What are the philosophical ramifications?
Now, before we take some questions from our live audience, Craig, there's a lot of hype associated with genomics. New diagnostics, new drugs, new sources of energy, designer babies, synthetic life forms. Help us separate the hype from the reality. What's like really on the horizon, and what's just science fiction imagination?
Well, right now we've only had one individual of our species to have his genome sequenced, and that was me. And it's very hard to interpret that information at this stage. We're trying to get the technology. With during the course of this radio show, you could get your own genome sequenced for maybe $1,000. That will happen within the decade.
Wouldn't it have been better to start with someone a little more typical? I mean, you're kind of...
Well, genetics always studies the odd character. That's how you learn things.
So within the decade, you'll be able to get your own genome sequence.
And so we'll have databases with hopefully millions of genome sequences and the corresponding phenotypic and clinical information. And that's the first time we'll be able to actually decipher questions about nature versus nurture. What's predictable, what's not. And I think there's going to be a lot of surprises in there for ourselves and for ourselves as a population
and
society.
Okay, but once we've got that, okay, within a decade, we'll be able to sequence people's genomes. But what about all this other stuff, designer babies, new sources of energy? Is that around the corner?
I wouldn't put the two in the same category. All of genetics works through selection, so the idea of having designer babies probably won't happen in the next century or two, but it probably will eventually happen as we get a thorough understanding of the genetic code. I think it's impossible for humanity to ignore the information and those challenges. New sources of energy are the challenges for the immediate future. I think we have to do something quickly. We're putting 3.5 billion tons of CO2 into the atmosphere. We can't keep doing that, or the genetic code will become irrelevant pretty quickly.
Tell me, how is genomics going to help us with new sources of energy? Not giving away trade secrets kind of thing.
I wish I had some. From the Sorcerer 2 expedition, we've been discovering millions of new genes just in the oceans around the world. We knew less than 1% of biology on our own planet. We're discovering so many new pathways that convert sunlight into energy for cells that drive the carbon cycle in the ocean. The conversion of sugar into butane, propane, even octane, replacing the oil and the coal industries, are absolute possibilities within the next couple of decades. Imagine the economic change that has, the environmental changes, the warfare changes for the world if we can do that.
So the first great beneficial effects of the revolution in genomic knowledge may really not be human health directly at all, but it may be help with our global warming problem.
It could be the biggest impact. There's already direct human health applications, improved diagnostics. We have new drugs such as Gleevec that are based on truly understanding the genetic code that are almost miracle drugs in terms of treating cancer. But we're seeing these slow revolutions. Basic science takes a long time to decipher with the limited information we have now.
But the thing that struck me, what you just said, it seems as though nature, evolution, is just an amazing thing. I mean, all these genetic resources, these are evolved creatures solving all kinds of problems, adaptive problems, you know, how to convert sunlight into usable energy for its metabolic processes. And it looks like nature has solved these problems a myriad of different ways. And we're just kind of like exploiting nature's locked-in knowledge through genomics.
If we can do that, that's all we need to do to properly survive here a long time. If we don't start doing that, We probably won't.
But John is a guy full of fears, right? He says, half full of what, right? Is there anything that gives you pause? I mean, are you just a gung-ho, let's-go-forward guy?
Well, like you, I'm an optimist. I think it's hard to be a scientist and not be an optimist. You can't look forward and make discoveries if you're not. But there's always concern. Any new technology, any new knowledge has always been abused by some. We have a challenge of science education in this country. That's one of the biggest challenges we face for the future, as people want to replace religion instead of learning science, understanding the basis of evolution that is so clear from our genetic code.
Well, now, I go back to language, for example. Language is not as complicated, I suppose, as the genome, but it's tremendously complicated. And people have occasionally come up with these proposals to improve language. George Bernard Shaw, Teddy Roosevelt, we're going to change the spelling, get rid of the subjunctive, a few things like that. It never works. Language seems to have evolved in this way that is beyond human intelligence to really improve. We have technical languages and so forth and so on, but pretty much it goes on its own. Is it possible that there's some kind of deep accumulated wisdom in the way that genomes work that we're really not going to succeed in changing?
Well, I think language is a great metaphor for the genome. It is a language. Mm-hmm. It's a digital language that has evolved over at least 4.5 billion years, unless life originated somewhere else and came here. We know all the genes basically for the mammalian type species, including ourselves. Our language, our genetic code differs only a few percent from those of mice, rats, dogs, and cats. And so the subtleties of the language are obviously important. You have a whole lot more hair than I do. His is a little curlier than mine is. You know, there are phenotypic differences that are very subtle changes, but they're minor changes in language that have been built in from these billions of years of evolution.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk, folks. We're talking about the promise and perils of the new genomics in front of a live studio audience, and I'd like to encourage our live studio audience to go to those microphones, and if you want to join into this discussion, we're eager to have your questions, and I see somebody settling up to the mic now. What's your comment or question?
It has to do with the title of your show is The Promise of Genomics. Could you, Craig, lay out for us and really fill in the picture in terms of the promise, giving a specific example? One might be example of what the benefits will be for cancer and cancer research. But play it out so we can really understand for the people in the audience what a specific benefit might be to your research.
Well, in fact, it's a great question. That's probably the most interesting area to pick is what's going on in cancer research. People have heard about colon cancer genes and breast cancer genes, but almost every type of inherited cancer that we get from inherent changes from our parents amounts to 3 to 5% of cancer. The rest is environmental changes in our genetic code. And what we are doing now is we're sequencing the genes in the tumors directly, finding those somatic changes that, in fact, are leading to new types of therapy where you can know which genes are wrong in the tumor, regardless of what happens in inheritance. There's a whole new set of tyrosine kinase inhibitors. Some have argued that in a few decades, we'll have a repertoire of 40 or 50 of these, depending on the spelling changes in the receptors in your tumor, we'll know which drug to give you. It's a very optimistic future. There's no indication it's a false optimism.
Oh, we've got another question on the other side of the room. We'll go back and forth here.
Craig, along a similar line, can you please tell us, in terms of new energy sources, how might genetics help us adapt new energy sources? You mentioned the changing of sugars, sunlight to sugar and things like that. How is that related to directly giving us new energy sources, and what might those new energy sources be?
Well, one of the most obvious ones right now, and most people are familiar with fermentation of sugar into alcohol that's been going on as long as humanity has existed.
I know you have, John.
So we're now adding ethanol to gasoline as a way of diluting it. That comes from sugar. But now that same sugar, using different metabolic pathways, can be converted into fuels we can burn directly, like butane or even propane, possibly octane, as I mentioned. Understanding the metabolic pathways for just metabolizing sugar, but sugar is not sufficient. We have to actually break down the cellulose from plant material to generate more sugar. So new enzymes called cellulases that break down this complex polymer could provide sufficient sugar to replace fuels directly that we get from oil and coal.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the promise and perils of the new genomics with Craig Fenter. We're in front of a live studio audience at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., and we have another question from our studio audience now.
Hi, I really am an optimist, honest, but I have a question about apparel. Not apparel, apparel.
You look lovely.
I recently learned that some insurance companies, if they know about a woman's BRCA status, are using that in underwriting decisions. And I was wondering what you think about that, and also if you, in any of your business enterprises, are doing anything specifically about that. I'm thinking about the Human Genome Project. At one point, it set aside 3% of its funding for ELSI issues. So I just didn't know how personally and as a business person you're grappling with things like that.
Let me press this question a little bit more. You said something optimistic but also scary. You said any individual in this room in 10 years will be able to get their genome sequenced for $1,000. Well, will an insurance company, just to follow up on this question, have the right to demand as a condition of their coverage of you that they see that?
They might. It's an important issue, and it's a part of understanding what's genetic determinism and what's not. I've argued that we need to pass this legislation in Washington, the Genetic Non-Discrimination Bill, not because in the long run it'll be useful for discrimination to have your genetic code. It's until we can get a common level of understanding that we're not basing things on prejudice versus actual scientific information, that we need that protection for individuals. My genome sequence is on the internet. I'm not the least bit worried about it. The insurance industry is very split on this. There's very few yes-no answers we'll ever get from our genetic code. We're going to get statistical probabilities. What does it mean to have a 30% increased risk of breast cancer?
This is where John's pessimism starts to bite for me, because what's going to determine how this goes? Well, we might think we're old-fashioned philosophers, we think, well, natural rights. Human beings have a right to privacy, ownership of information about themselves. But what's going to settle this in our society? A combination of capitalism and politics, greed, and all this stuff. And who knows where it's going to shake out, whether for the good of individuals or for the ill.
Well, insurance companies use genetic information now. If you ever had your blood pressure taken or your family history, you've been giving your genomic information to insurance companies. So it's not a huge shift to have them use a specific gene-based thing. The insurance industry is actually split on this, whether it will even be useful to them. But I think it's very important that Washington pass this legislation, at least until we understand it. More importantly, for employment, where discrimination is not ever rational.
Well, yeah, we do have the feeling that we have privacy and we ought to control information about ourselves, but we really don't have an awful lot of that left. Because I mean, to get a cell phone, you have to give up your social security number. To get insurance, you have to tell most of what you know. You have to sign over that your doctor can fill out a report. Presumably, good knowledge is better than poor knowledge. So this is one thing I don't feel too pessimistic about. I'm pretty sure that in the next 50 years, Europe will handle it a lot better than we do, but what else is new?
I don't know why you think that. We have another question from our live audience.
First, a comment. Given your discussion of the genome of the fruit fly and the human being, I now understand why I like summer fruit so much, particularly peaches. Now for my question. As a psychiatrist, I read your short essay on your most dangerous idea on the web. And it was very interesting because you were talking about a chance finally to lock down a true idea of how much of the human personality in psychology is embodied within the genome, laid down in a hardwired way perhaps, and how much of it is due to exogenous environmental experience. Can you run with that idea a little bit further and project what we're going to find?
Well, I certainly can't project what we're going to find, except we're going to be able to answer these questions. And I think we're going to be struggling with these issues as a society. People like the blank slate idea. We're all born and created equal. I used to be in athletics. There were certainly people that had a lot better athletic skills than I did. So I learned early on genetics was certainly not equal. We're not used to dealing with these ideas that personality, intelligence, even behavior is inherited. But we did the dog genome and found that different behaviors are clearly genetic. How much of ours remains to be discovered? I think we're afraid of those ideas for the reasons you worry about control and manipulation of the information. We will know those answers soon. I can't tell you what they'll be.
Craig, as we come up to break, I want to ask you a question maybe you can answer very shortly. That's a little off topic. You said before that the human genome goes back, a couple billion years, assuming that life began on Earth. Now, some of the people I really admire, like Francis Crick and Kurt Gödel, the logician, really took seriously the idea that life didn't begin on Earth. It was somehow sent here from somewhere else, Krypton or somewhere. So I'm just interested in what somebody of your expertise thinks about that idea, which sounds so strange to me.
Well, panspermia is certainly not something we can dismiss. It was dismissed early on because we extrapolated from human existence and said nothing could survive in outer space. We now have microorganisms that can take 3 million rads of radiation. They can be completely desiccated in a vacuum. You put them in an aqueous solution, just a little bit of water. They repair the damage to their DNA, and they start replicating again. So we know life can survive in outer space, and it's a question of how long it would take to get to the Earth from some distant galaxy in a form that could land in the oceans and start replicating. Mm-hmm. We exchanged 200 kilograms of material between Earth and Mars each year. If panspermia did not occur before, it certainly will now as we contaminate the universe with biological material from the Earth.
So this is not as crazy an idea as it might appear?
Not at all.
Okay. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the promise and perils of genomics with Craig Venter in front of a live audience at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C.
We've been talking about the practical applications and some of the attendant social consequences of the new genetics. In our next segment, we'll explore a few of the potential ethical dilemmas raised by the intersection of genomics and global capitalism.
The ownership of genes, genetic privacy, genetic colonialism, and more questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
That was David Bowie and Gene Genie. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing genomics with noted scientist and entrepreneur Craig Venter in front of a live studio audience at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., our beloved capital.
Should genes be privately owned and commercially exploited? Is the patenting and commercial exploitation by first world biotechnology companies of the genetic raw materials of the third world a threat that's going to give us a new form of genetic colonialism? Should individuals have a right to genetic privacy? These are a few of the daunting questions that the new genomics is forcing us to confront.
Craig, in March 2000, President Clinton and Prime Minister Blair declared that the genome sequence should be made freely available to all researchers. That's a noble-sounding idea. I know you were deep in the middle of this then. And I recall that 2 days after that, the biotech companies had lost like $50 billion in market valuation. But actually, the patenting and privatizing of genetic information had already happened a lot, and it continued apace after that. Here's my question for you. Is the patenting of genetic information a good thing or a bad thing? One might think, you know, the gene is part of the commons, and so it shouldn't be privately owned. What do you think?
It's a very complex field that people really have trouble grasping it initially, because your initial response is totally right. Nobody can own your genes. They can't own my genes. I one time joked that I was going to patent my genome, and then I got a call from my mother. And the experiment's been tried over and over again. There's times where it's very critical. When the protein erythropoietin was discovered by Amgen to play a critical role in inducing synthesis of new red blood cells, anybody who was on kidney dialysis was delighted that that gene was patentable and that it was produced commercially. The same with insulin. Diabetics used to be treated with pig insulin, and they become resistant to it until human insulin gene was cloned. These are rare exceptions. There's some diagnostics. The BRCA1 and BRCA2 gene are commercially available because, in fact, they were funded by biotech companies in making those discoveries. The rare exceptions will soon go away, and they don't affect the developing world any more than they affect you and I.
So are you, I mean, is it good? I mean, some people think the genome is out there in the commons. People should have common access to it. Other people think, well, look, we take it out of the commons and we privatize it, and that gives us a motive to innovate and explore. I'm not quite sure I understand where you stand on that.
Well, in fact, we have the patent office here in Washington. The patents actually guarantee the information is in the public domain.
Because you have to disclose it.
Because you have to disclose it to get a patent. So most people mistakenly associate patents with secrecy. In fact, they're the opposite of trade secrecy. They force the disclosure of this information. So any company, any university, the U.S. government has more gene patents than any company does. When they get that patent, they have to disclose it publicly. All they have a right to do is produce something from it commercially. They don't own it.
Now, there's another field that I believe you're a pioneer in, too, that's called synthetic genomics, where I guess the patenting issue would be a little bit more straightforward. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it's uncertain whether there's a patenting issue yet. Synthetic genomics is right now a hypothetical field. As we go from the analog world of biology into the digital world of DNA sequence, we're now starting to be able to go back from that digital world and synthetically make the DNA to go back and recreate biology. The promise of this, if we could truly understand how to design biology, would be to create organisms that could capture CO2 back from the environment, reverse environmental damage, produce chemicals instead of using oil and coal. DuPont is doing a very critical experiment with a bacteria they modified to convert sugar into propanediol using tons of bacteria. This is going to be the first multi-billion-dollar biotech product that's not a therapeutic.
We have more questions from our live studio audience. Over there.
My question is on the environmental impact of synthetic organisms. Take global warming and an organism that you say might be able to absorb CO2. Imagine the quantity of microorganisms that would need to be created. I know a little bit about ecology and evolution, and natural selection and evolution is a rather slow and deliberate process taking millions of years in nature. Taking such a large quantity of synthetic microorganisms and introducing them into the environment as a miracle species would obviously not follow that historical pattern of evolution. How would we safeguard the environment from these synthetic creatures?
It's a very good question, but there were several leaps of the imagination there in terms of one of the promises of synthetic genomics and molecular biology is metabolism can be changed by as much as a million-fold in the laboratory. So you don't have to fill the oceans with new species to change how things are done. You can put just closed-loop systems on power plants, which are the single biggest polluter that we have in our own environment, without things ever getting out into the environment. This is one of the fears that came out decades ago with the start of molecular biology, that all these manipulations of genes was going to create monsters out in the environment. Nothing has ever escaped from a laboratory because it's very easy to create and modify organisms so they're dependent on certain antibiotics or certain chemicals. And out of the millions and millions of experiments that have been done over decades, there's never been a single accident.
But that's experiments. I think his question, though, to affect something like global warming, we'd have to alter the consumption of carbon dioxide on a massive scale, it would seem. And one might wonder, right? I mean, nature is a delicately balanced system. Right, and
we've ruined that balance already.
That's true.
So that's the problem. The balance has been ruined. Actually, it only takes a 10% solar efficiency conversion, a few square miles of the Arizona desert, to generate all the energy we need to replace everything we're using in transportation. That has a huge effect on how much CO2 we're putting in the environment. We don't have to suck it all back in if we stop what we're doing.
So the specter that bothers people, certainly bothers me, is the kind of thing where somebody's imported a little fish from Indonesia and it turns out to ruin the Everglades or the San Francisco Delta, or all the frogs up in my neck of the woods are being eaten by something. But you're saying that actually at the smaller level, at the level of the genetic engineering, there's some safeguards that were not possible in the kind of age of transplanting living, evolved organisms.
Exactly. In fact, let me give you a real nightmare scenario of what happens every day. If you look at the hundreds of thousands of gallons of ballast water in a ship, each milliliter of that contains 1 million bacteria and 10 million viruses. So a ship that goes from one part of the world, bringing its ballast water and dumping it in Baltimore Harbor, is moving literally trillions of organisms putting them in a new environment where they never were before.
We have another questioner from our live audience.
I have a question that goes back to Mr. Venter about science education, because I'm sitting here listening to you. I've been out of college for a long time. My field is not science, and I'm having a hard time understanding everything that you're saying. So it seems to me that to appreciate the problem and to be able to do something about it, especially as regards environmental issues, how do you suggest that we keep our populace, myself included, educated, and so that we can actually understand what's important from what's not so important and do something useful with the genetic information?
I think it's a great question. I'm more troubled by science education in this country than almost any other issue. I think the only reason I was able to become a scientist is I avoided as much of the education system as I could for as long as I could. So my curiosity was not driven out of me. You add into that the influence of religion and trying to eliminate discussion of evolution and scientific fact, it becomes very complicated. It's one of the key issues. Science doesn't have to be taught on memorization. You don't have to memorize anything from tonight. These are not complicated concepts. They're pretty simple ones. And I think if we teach them as concepts with the implications for what they mean for our society, we'll have a very educated population that can make informed decisions.
We have time for one last questioner on this side of the room.
Dr. Venter, would you address the public policy implications of making practical what is now, to a large extent, basic scientific knowledge? Can we advance materially the speed with which we get discoveries that capture the public imagination, capture their willingness to support public funding of basic scientific research? How much effect would additional funding have on advancing the pace of realizing basic science discoveries?
It's a wonderful question. It's not just the amount of funding, it's what gets funded. Almost every one of the discoveries that I've been associated with came through because I had the funds to do the research without asking for money for years and then waiting to do it. We're very good at funding things we know the answer for in this country. Almost anything that's truly a new idea, it's virtually impossible to get government funding for. And that's a wonderful thing we have with all these private foundations, even the private markets, to help fund new things. That when we sequenced the first genome, the government wouldn't fund it. As soon as we showed the ideas worked, the government came forth with tons and tons of money. So it's not a matter of just throwing more money at the question. We've got to find some intelligent ways to use that money and to give it to people that can make true breakthroughs.
Well, on that note, we're going to have to thank you for joining us. It's been a real pleasure having you on Philosophy Talk.
Well, it's been a pleasure being here.
Our guest has been Craig Venter, founder, former CEO of Celera Genomics, founder and current director of the Craig Venter Institute, founder, chairman, and CEO of Synthetic Genomics.
We also want to thank everyone in our live audience for participating in the program. Give yourselves a round of applause.
You were a great audience. You asked some great questions. And get us on the air in the Washington area. That's how you can help science literacy in the public of America. So, John, what did we learn today? Where's your thoughts?
Well, I guess I'm less pessimistic at the end of the show than at the beginning, but still basically pessimistic. maybe, you know, each new scientific discovery's first great claim to fame is undoing the mischief of the last one. But Craig Venter explained some things very aptly, and then maybe there aren't as many dangers as this as I thought. I would like to say something personal about Craig Venter. He's a graduate of San Mateo College from a junior college system in California. And I think he is a great tribute to one thing about America, maybe the only thing, that works, namely its system of higher education and its ability to not let talent slip away because it doesn't kind of get into the groove in junior high high school. I think of myself in that same category. Yeah. That's the reason I'm happy to mention
you're
it.
You're committing the fallacy of the base rate. You don't know how many have slipped away and never showed up. So, but I started out an optimist, and I'm deeply optimistic. I love science. I adore science. And I say, go, 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 science. Right? And because, I mean, science is it's the thing that's thrown off all blind. That human being gradually this blinder, that blinder. Science is the greatest thing.
So we can know how inconsequential and trivial and maybe even Earth, which I love, wasn't the beginning of it all.
Look,
Gimini Christmas, Ken.
I got to tell you, if I were younger, starting over again, I might become a genomics guy because I think this is a really cool time. 23,000 genes and these complicated creatures, hardly more genes than a fruit fly, and with these complicated. How does that happen? That's a great mystery. And we're on the verge of solving that. So I think it's great. I'm deeply optimistic, gung-ho. But you know what, folks? This conversation has to come to an end for now, but it continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog. Go check it out.
And you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. But now, with the last word on the human genome, Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, not being a scientist or a lawyer or even much of a capitalist, it's hard for me to make sense of the fact that somebody or some entity can own a gene. We've already had extremely bizarre and complicated legal issues. There was a guy in Seattle, John Moore. In 1976, rare hairy cell leukemia cells were removed from his spleen. He had signed a form allowing research to be done on the tissues. The subsequent research led to a patent on what is called the Mohs cell line, which produced cancer-fighting proteins. In the late 1980s, Moore sued, thinking that if somebody were going to make money off his body parts, he wanted a piece of it. At the time, according to the Seattle Times, he was, quote, the only human known to have been patented in whole or in part, unquote. And there's the genetic disorder called Canavan's disease, a spongy degeneration of the brain. Parents of those afflicted, according to Salon, had been sending blood and tissue samples to a researcher at Miami Children's Hospital. Eventually, the researcher identified the Canavan mutation gene. In 1998, the hospital announced that it would license its patent on it and that clinicians pay a royalty each time they perform the test and put a cap on the number of tests any academic lab could do. Wait a second, said the parents. Are you saying you own our kids' disease? That's not just wrong, it's creepy. And there's the farmer in Canada, a hero or a thief, depending on your point of view. Monsanto had modified a canola gene to make it resistant to a Monsanto weed killer, which is kind of like having your cake and eating it too. Monsanto has a rule. When you buy Roundup Ready canola, you agree to buy new seed every year to pay for future research to make better plants. For 7 years, Percy Schmeiser wouldn't pay. He claimed the seeds had landed on his farm by accident, and he didn't know they were Monsanto. Some say he should have known when they didn't die after he sprayed them with weed killer. Anyway, Monsanto sued him for stealing seeds. He argued back, according to the CBC, that a company can't patent a plant. The case went to Canada's highest court, which did agree with Schmeiser that the plant is a higher life form and cannot be patented, but said the patent does apply to the gene. But he didn't have to pay a fine, so that happened. And what has happened since? This is from the website Center for Cooperative Research, which offers a timeline of the whole Monsanto-Percy Schmeiser battle. Quote, after Percy Schmeiser finds volunteer Roundup Ready canola plants growing on a 50-acre parcel of his farm, he calls Monsanto and asks them to remove the plants. A team of Monsanto investigators shows up and offers to remove the plants. But before they do so, they ask him to sign a legal release, releasing the company of all liability. Schmeiser refuses. With neither side willing to give in to the other's demands, Schmeiser removes the plants himself in October 21st. A Monsanto spokesperson insists the company is under no legal obligation to remove plants that show up in fields uninvited, unquote. So there you go, some skirmishes in the bioethics war. What about clones, you ask? Well, don't sweat the clones, my friend. What are they going to do, look like you to death? I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks to Melody Curtis, Jillian Lee, Barbara Tusling, and all the fine folks at the Smithsonian Associates, as well as Stanford in Washington. Also thanks to Devin Strolovich, Neil Van Leeuwen, and John O'Leary. Our senior consulting producer is Gordon Earle.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the Friends of Philosophy Talk. That's you.
And the members of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, even if they should.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.